Welcome to Creating a Passionate Partnership with Rita DeMaria. I'm Frankie Dorn, the president of Relationship Coaching Institute. And before we start, I just want to remind you that by going to the portal page and clicking on this program link, you can do a whole bunch of things. You can listen to this call via webcast from your computer. You can submit questions to Rita during the program, and we'll try to get to as many of them as time permits. You can access Rita's bonus, which is two free audio recordings, What Makes a Good Marriage and the Benefits of Relationship Education. You can also access Rita's book, Seven Stages of Marriage, Laughter, Intimacy, and Passion Today, Tomorrow, Forever. You can also access the audio recording of this session once it's complete, and you can submit your feedback about this program. So I've muted all the lines just to eliminate any background noise. And we're really excited to have Rita with us today. And Rita DeMaria is the Director of Relationship Education at the Council for Relationships in Philadelphia. And that's where she's also in clinical practice and is a faculty member and supervisor for the AAMFT Accredited Postgraduate Training Program in MFT. And she's also the author of the book, The Seven Stages of Marriage, as I've just mentioned. And Rita has appeared as a relationship and marriage expert on numerous national TV programs and is frequently quoted in many top publications. So today we'll cover in our program the dimensions and possibilities of love in modern marriages. We'll talk about the developmental tasks essential for all healthy, loving, and transformative relationships. And finally, we'll talk about the possibilities for sexual pleasure in long-term committed relationships. And I hope, Rita, that as we do that, we're also going to be talking about the seven stages of marriage, because I think that is so relevant. So welcome, Rita. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be involved with this wonderful program that you're having. And I just would like to say that in addition to the many years of practice I have, which is probably about 35, I've also been in a long-term, committed, loving marriage for 30 years.
Wow.
So sometimes I like to say that I figured out a way to practice what I teach other people. And the reverse of that, though, is that, you know, being in the field and learning about possibilities and strategies and skills and all the knowledge base, and it's so exciting today what's going on, really has helped me in my own personal life. So there's an overlap between what I do with people professionally, both clinically and in teaching classes, but also the benefits to myself because, you know, I'm one of these people. I grew up in a family where my mother told me that she fell in love with my father when she was 12 years old, and he died when she was 50 of a young death, but she remained in love with him for another 25 years, even when he wasn't around. And, you know, a lot of times people say, well, you know, you fall in love and then you kind of have to get over it. Well, that really hasn't sit well with me over the years. So I've put a lot of time and energy to understanding how it is that people who have loving, passionate, long-term relationships, what do they know that the rest of us don't? So that's why I've put a lot of my time and energy.
Well, and it's amazing that when you work in this field, what you learn in your profession is it's amazing that you can bring that into your personal life, and there's so much self-growth from that. So, yeah, and I can relate to that absolutely. So, Rita, where would you like to start today?
I'll start with talking about the seven stages of marriage, which was a project that I did with Reader's Digest. Reader's Digest, a few years back, did a market research survey, and they found out that there really wasn't a lot out in the field about the stages of marriage. There's a lot about what the skills are and a lot of other things, but what are the stages? So this project, actually, we put a model together and borrowed from lots of research and lots of experience in the field and came up with the seven stages. And I'll go over those briefly. The first stage is the passion stage, and that, of course, is the falling in love stage. And most people, when they make a commitment and they do get married, it's usually somewhere around 2 or 3 years after they've actually fallen in love. Some people do it more quickly than others, but, you know, the average is about 2 years. But what most people don't realize is that it is really important in those first few years after getting married or making a commitment to be together that you have to remember that you want to keep that going, because the memories and experiences that are formed during the passion stage, they really help us out through all the other stages. Mm. They become the foundation. We know from some of the research going on now how powerful those falling in love experiences are. And they get stored in our brains, and we don't ever lose them. So we want to be able to access, we want to reinforce that part of the relationship early on. So that's the passion stage. The second stage is, go ahead.
I just have one question about that. We know that there's a lot of chemicals that are, you know, coursing through our bodies during this stage. But one of the oxytocin, for example, really helps with the bonding. And is that what you're referring to? There's that bonding, and it's around the memories and the feelings in this stage that really helps keep us grounded?
That's part of it. Actually, oxytocin is the one that actually helps us as we move along. When we fall in love, it's the PEA and the dopamine and how that what that does, it sort of like seals those memories in our memory banks. And we want to stay with that as long as we can. Now, I would say that oxytocin is sort of like the ongoing salve that we live with when we maintain a bonded relationship with our partners. So, yeah, all the chemistry of all this is really fascinating stuff.
Great. That's been helpful.
What happens next, though, is the realization stage. And that's where, you know, people have sort of come to rest with the falling in love, and now they're really getting to know the other person. And one of the things I often say to people is it really takes us a lifetime to get to know someone. We think we met our soulmate in the passion stage, but really it's a process of becoming soulmates over time. Because as we get to know someone, that's when we begin to understand them, more compassionate, you weather the storms. So the realization stage is the beginning of, I'm getting to know more about you. Some people will joke and say, oh, I thought it was, I realized I made a mistake. But it's really not about that, and unless somebody really did make a mistake. But that's usually not what drives people apart in the early part of a relationship. So the realization stage is getting to know each other. And one of the important tasks in the realization stage is learning how to communicate. You know, everybody knows communication is important. Well, this is the foundation. And this is the time to begin working on being more empathetic with each other and really take time to hear out the other person's point of view. So that's the realization stage, which is the second stage. Then the third stage follows that, which we call rebellion. Now, rebellion is, and I kind of summarize it, well, now that I'm getting to know you, I really would rather do everything my way. You know, this is the time when we've got to figure out how we're really going to live together, whose traditions are we going to follow, how are we going to organize our lives. And generally speaking, most of us are more comfortable doing it the way we've always done it than doing it someone else's way. And this is where conflict begins. And this is the stage where if people are not able to resolve their conflicts and differences and come up with agreements that are satisfying to both, that we see marriages begin to break down. This is generally about that 5-year mark where people are really starting to get stuck and really feeling like they're not getting their needs met. And we know from all the research that it has to do with not having strong enough conflict resolution skills, problem-solving skills, negotiating skills, depending on who you're talking to at the time. So the rebellion stage is really the peak time when relationships begin to break down, and it's actually the peak time for divorce.
So this is around the time that, I guess, the 5 to 7 year, you know, you've heard of the 7-year itch.
Mm-hmm.
This is really what's happening. The couple is in that rebellion stage.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, the 7-year itch is kind of interesting because you know, everybody, like, where does it really happen? Well, it sort of begins when you first fall in love. It's kind of 7 years from when that started. Since most people don't tend to start a committed relationship or getting married at the moment they fall in love, we really see, I think, from all the research I've done, that it's about 4 years into the marriage where the 7-year itch is really starting to take place. And it's very closely related to the rebellion stage, which is, you know, my needs are important and I'm not getting my needs met. And even though I love you, this isn't working out as easily as I thought it would.
And are we seeing at this time resentment building, or does that happen in the realization stage? Like, if your needs are not met, is that where the resentment starts to come in?
Yes, and that's the resentment is all part of the rebellion stage.
Okay.
Because that's where the anger is building up, and either people are becoming volatile or they're avoiding conflict. And this is really where people get in trouble. And we know that probably about 75% of divorces take place by 5 to 7 years into the relationship. And we know from research that, you know, most couples know for quite some time that there are problems brewing, but they don't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Often it's because they you know, as this goes on in the beginning, we start to think, well, I picked the wrong person. This is just not the person I thought they were. But often it's about my ability to speak up for myself and my needs. Now, assuming people are making it through this time, and sometimes, you know, as life goes, especially for people who want to have children, they've often had a child or maybe two during all of this. And the next stage that they go into is cooperation. So you can see if people have not worked through the foundation of the knowing how to communicate clearly, being able to resolve differences, when they come to the cooperation stage, which is really building a life together, a home, you know, work, all the things that people need to do, they can be in big trouble at this point. But assuming things have gone more smoothly, this is the time where people start really working out traditions and finances and, you know, children or not, or other relationships, careers, work, going back to school. It's a time of really building a foundation and a future with each other.
And what occurs to me is, Do you know what the role of commitment is in helping people move past the rebellion stage into the cooperation stage? Is it just, you know, that they're hanging in there?
Commitment is important. For some people, yes, especially if they've had children, there is that constraint that they feel like they have to go forward. But in general, for most people, if they're making it into the cooperation stage, they really still have a sense that they are in love or love this person that they're with. And that's really what ultimately is going to drive the commitment. So I should mention that in each stage, we really have to pay attention to dating because, you know, part of this topic is how do you create a passionate partnership? Well, one of the things that we have to do is as we go along in each stage, we need to adapt ourselves to the challenges of that stage in terms of how, you know, dating and being romantic with each other. And what happens with the rebellion stage and into the cooperation stage is that sometimes that starts to go to the wayside and people stop spending time. They stop doing those special things. You know, we won't celebrate our anniversary this year. We're only going to take family vacations. You know, we don't need to take that special trip that we were planning. So that's really important for people to realize that as we go through the stages, we have to pay attention to that bond, as you were talking about, and the sexual relationship. Because interestingly enough, the oxytocin comes with holding and being held, but it also comes with having a satisfying sexual relationship because oxytocin is released at orgasm.
Yep. And if you're not having sex, you're probably not having orgasms.
Probably not. And the problem is if you're not having sex, and especially for men in the earlier stages, I think, there's a level of frustration and worse yet rejection that they are feeling, so they start to pull away. And that is exactly the wrong formula for women because they really need to be held and touched and have close men. But if the guys are suffering, you know, with deprivation, as I call it, during this time, they're not going to be reaching out. She's not going to get her needs for touch met. When she's not getting her needs for touch and closeness and talking met, then she's not able to relax. And it just sets up a vicious cycle that for many couples, 10 years, 14 years into their relationship, they look at each other and say, what happened?
Mm.
You know, what's
Where's
going on?
Where's the spark?
Where is the spark? Yeah, that's exactly what they say. You know, I'm not sure I'm in love with you anymore. And that is, again, when sometimes marriages get in trouble because people begin to meet and connect with what I call attractive alternatives.
Mm.
This person shows me time and attention and energy, because where do we spend a lot of our time and energy? At work. So affairs tend to peak during the rebellion stage, but then as the cooperation stage, if couples are not attending to their intimate, sexual, physical, affectionate relationship, they're going to get into trouble.
Okay.
Now, the cooperation stage lasts longer than most. And again, it's partly dependent on how many children you have, if you're having children, or, and I'll talk about remarried couples in a second. But, you know, so if somebody has four or five children, their cooperation stage before the children are launched is going to take longer than someone who has one or a couple who chooses not to, to have children.
Right.
And so couples today have many more choices. You'd think that if you don't have children, it's easier to attend to the intimacy and the close, physical closeness in couples, but I find that can be just as problematic. People can get lost in their work and careers as easily as they can get lost in taking care of their children.
Yeah. It's very easy to make busy.
Oh, yes. Very easy. Now, it's kind of interesting because people say, what about remarried couples? Now, the problem for couples that are coming together who have been married before and generally are bringing children or other complications, they end up having to negotiate the passion stage, the realization stage, the rebellion stage, and the cooperation stage all at once, which creates for a tremendous amount of stress for couples that are remarrying and having to recreate a life. And, you know, think about it. You're in love and you get married and you think it's going to be wonderful, and now you're trying to figure out finances and children and
mm-hmm.
holiday schedules. It puts an inordinate amount of stress on couples who are remarrying, who have been in relationships. And it doesn't matter if one or both. The stress of all of those demands increases problems, because they really haven't gotten to know each other, they haven't learned how to communicate, they haven't learned how to resolve their differences, and they're dealing with pretty large life issues.
Mm-hmm. And that rebellion stage is right in the middle of everything that's going on. It's mixed in.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult. And each stage has several developmental tasks that ideally we have some time to work through. Now, life is never quite so simple. For most of us, so we have to negotiate it as we can. But I think when people are coming together who have been in other relationships, have other children, are remarrying, it's just much more complicated. So it's not surprising that those marriages, second marriages, third marriages, even fourth marriages, have a much higher risk of breakup in that early time, because mm-hmm. it's too much, and because people don't have the support systems they need as well.
Right.
And so assuming the cooperation stage goes under sort of average conditions, now couples have been together probably about 20 years or so, 25, and they would be then moving into the reunion stage. And we changed that from empty nest, which sounds like you're going to lose something, rather than reunion, where you're going to gain something.
Mm-hmm.
Gain is getting back together with life being a little more settled than it has been, and you really know each other. I can say more about the reunion stage, but I'd like to mention the explosion stage, because that's the sixth stage. And the explosion stage actually is about life stress and challenges, and it really can happen at any time. For example, I had a friend who had a breast cancer diagnosis when her son was in first grade. You know, that's not typically when that happens, but it did happen. So that created an explosion stage that interfered or overran the cooperation stage for her and forced a lot of different life decisions. And some people are fortunate and they don't get have explosion stage, while other people have 10 of them, you know, different challenges.
Yep.
So the explosion stage, I liken this model because it's a way to look at how stress impacts on your particular life. And when you have an explosion stage, it does derail you for a while, but it doesn't mean you can't get back on track. And that's what I think, what I hear people saying that they like about this is it kind of says, okay, we've been through that, now what do we do? Oh, okay, we'll go into this stage.
Yeah, and I guess it depends when it happens, you know, what the likelihood of successfully navigating this and staying, having the relationship stay intact. Because if it were to happen in the early stages, that relationship probably would go by the wayside. But later on, maybe in the cooperation or reunion stage, it's probably more easily managed. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think it is. Although I do think, because we know, for example, couples who have a child who is chronically ill or has a terminal illness, some of those couples just don't make it, and some do. And so what's the difference between those that do and those that don't? Well, usually they have more communication. They're usually a little better at resolving differences. They're usually a little better at making sure that they have time for each other. They usually have more of a support system, you know, people in their lives who can say, hey, listen, you two need a break. You know, I'm going to help out this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So having those sort of protective factors is really important for couples as when they have these different explosion stages. And they can be individual issues, you know, somebody who has a depression or a job loss or, you know, an unexpected death in the family or some other kind of life trauma or stress. Or there can be things that happen to the couple, you know, they when it's a child, for example. So explosions come in lots of different forms and can happen throughout. And usually when we have these models, okay, this is how the process works, we forget that life can interfere.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that because it can, and I think we all need to know what we need. And generally speaking, when we have the explosion stages, we need a lot more support in our life.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Okay, so then the reunion stage. Now, this is a very interesting stage because this is the chance for the couple, and if they've been paying attention to their relationship, a lot of couples will say it's better than ever. And they have a chance to reconnect. They have a chance to, you know, take those trips that they wanted to take, and they have a chance to do all those things they had hoped to do. But one of the things, unfortunately, that is a task in that stage, which couples always say, oh, no, when I tell them this, is, you know, there usually hasn't been time to unpack old baggage. You know, as we go along in life, things happen. We're not as supportive or caring or loving or whatever that we may have wanted to be, but, you know, time didn't permit. So this is a time when couples really need to see if they can work through unresolved issues between themselves.
So it's really an opportunity for a new beginning, but they have to clean out, as you said, the old baggage.
Yes.
They really need to be clear what's hanging on. Yeah, spring cleaning. Great way to put it.
Yeah, because, you know, things just happen, and so being able to forgive each other is a really important task during the reunion stage. Forgive, not necessarily forget, but work through those issues, and more self-acceptance as well. So some couples, you know, actually they go on a spiritual, you know, adventure at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Their relationship expands. So the reunion stage is a really important one.
Yeah, and just looking at the age of a couple, you know, if we're looking at the cooperation stage maybe lasting 25 years, by the time we get into reunion stage, you know, what's our average age of couple there? 50,
but,
50 plus?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, yeah, you know, I mean, the average age right now of couples getting married is about 27.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, most couples then, so their late 50s, they may be getting into the reunion stage. But that's not universal. And also we know that, right now we have a marriage rate that's only about 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually means we probably have people who are getting into committed relationships and into marriage a little later. And so it may even happen later, or they may have many more challenges to deal with. And I think the important thing for people to realize is that there are tasks of each stage. It's not necessarily how long it's going to take you, but do you master what it is you need to master? You know, the early stages, you really want to make sure you have a good foundation in passion and romance between you.
Okay. And can we, when we're finished with the stages, the seven stages, can we talk a little bit about those challenges or the things that we need to master in each stage, and then maybe some
sure.
tips for how we can overcome that?
Sure.
That'd be
so
great.
Okay, so the last stage then after the reunion stage is actually called the completion stage. We called it the completion stage in the seven stages of marriage. But a book just came out called September Songs, and it talks about contentment. And in a lot of ways, that's also part of it. And these are the couples generally who have been together all of their adult lives. They're more into retirement. They've worked through the stages, and they really, these are the couples that they, you know, the newspapers and the TV stations and the radio go and get them on Valentine's Day. Okay, guys, this is how great it can be, you know, and these couples are very much in love and talk about how wonderful it is, and they touch each other, and I usually say when they're on TV, they even start looking like each other. You know, they've been together so long.
All they need is the dog,
yeah,
and then
right.
all three of them can look alike.
Yes. And, you know, we're living longer. So actually that particular stage has incredible possibilities. And it is a stage where people, you know, get involved in the world, in their communities, and, you know, just it really can have a wonderful life. And, yes, they really know each other. And I think that's where these are the people that really say, we've become soulmates. We really know each other. We really understand each other. I know he has those warts, and I know she has those quirks, but you know what? She's just the one, and I wouldn't do it any other way. In the Reader's Digest survey, 70% of the people said that they would marry the same person over again. It didn't matter what stage they were in, but that was an overarching consensus that they would pick the same person over again. But the majority of the ones who said that, of course, were in the completion stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
the completion stage. Go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking. I do some work with couples who are moving into retirement, so they're probably the latter part of the cooperation stage, maybe moving into the reunion stage. And one of the things that always surprises me is that most couples don't have a vision, like individually, a vision of what they want for their life. And the big majority don't have a shared vision.
Right.
So how important is that, you know, in these latter stages?
It's very important. And this is also a time in the completion stage for sort of reorganizing your life and the way you've been and accommodating to the current interests. And for couples as they go on, there really is more of a sense of living in the now. You know, you're not necessarily planning ahead and, you know, hopefully, you know, in this economy, hopefully you've got enough money to support you for the years that you're going to be around or what you've made those arrangements. But it is really important for people to say, okay, how do we want to live together now? And that's a turning point. In reunion, it's more about coming back together, working through any old baggage, you know, negotiating into the retirement. But in the completion stage, it's much more about how do we live together now? What do we want to do? How do we enjoy our life? Now, the downside is, you know, and this is why some people don't like the word completion, there is an end in sight generally. People know that chances are one person is not going to survive the other. One person is going to be, you know, leaving this planet before the other. And so issues around death and loss, sometimes illness, really become part of this particular stage as well.
And the flip side of that is that there are many more octogenarians living today than ever before. So our lifespan is increasing. And so, you know, we're probably going to be together longer than we ever anticipated.
Right. Assuming you get through those early
stages. You do.
The truth is, the statistics are that if you make it through the first 7 years, your chance and risk of divorce is only about 35%, one out of three, because the majority of those breakups take place in the first 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
So if you make it through that part, your chances of staying together, and then if you make it past the reunion, you know, there is a bit of a peak. I don't think we have consensus about it, about what happens when the children leave, because for some couples, they really have had sort of a unconscious and sometimes conscious agreement that they're just going to stay together until the kids are launched. But for most people, making it into the reunion stage and through it, the chances of them divorcing are very, very slim.
Mm-hmm.
Very slim. The real risk is that one person's going to pass on before the other.
Yeah.
And so that's an important issue for couples to attend to. And also the health issues, as you're saying, people are living longer, and we're living healthier. You know,
yes.
So those are all good things.
Yeah.
So those are the seven stages: passion, realization, rebellion, cooperation, reunion, explosion, and completion.
Great. Now, it occurs to me that, I mean, who knew this? You know, if you were just starting out in a relationship and at the 2-year mark, you know, you started to not feel the same level of passion. And I mean, I think this is a problem that a lot of new couples face. The relationship changes and they think something's wrong with the relationship. They don't understand it is just a stage. You know, there's 6 more stages. And because they don't understand that, they're probably, you know, much more inclined to leave the relationship. How do you think this knowledge that, you know, there are stages, that, you know, the passion stage is just one of them, it's the first one of them, how do you think that would impact people's decisions to stay on and just stick it out?
Well, I think that the, you know, this is the value of marriage education, relationship education for people, because people don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the possibilities for marriage today are so much different than they were when my mother and grandmother married. You know, things were just very different. There's a certain equality that exists today between men and women that just hasn't been a possibility in past generations. You know, my mother, it was the traditional kind of thing, and all the implications from, you know, the wars and everything they had been through. But she was quite content, but the dynamic changes when you are in a relationship where both people expect to have a partnership and be peers and respect, and we're going to share in this, how that all works. So it is a very exciting time, and it's hard sometimes for younger couples, unless they know older couples who have negotiated all that, to really know what's in store. And of course, then with the divorce rate being so high, and many of the young people getting married today are really frightened because they grew up during the time when the divorce rate went up. Now that was a good thing, because the old divorce rate was problematic because it really disenfranchised women in particular during the divorce process. So things change, but they don't have the perspective to understand what that was all about. But mm-hmm. So many young people are bringing fears of the possibilities when, you know, I talk about this is very exciting time.
Well, yeah, it's very exciting. And certainly if you overlay these stages on self-growth, self-awareness, I mean, you're really learning more and more about yourself. You're aware that there is an ebb and a flow to relationship. And, you know, how do you fit into it? What are your choices? What are your actions around that? And what occurs to me is that I think there's more and more people who are stuck in repeating the passion stage, you know, over and over and over. They just don't move past it.
Right. And unfortunately, when the more you go into it, actually, it's not as intense as the previous time. Our strongest loves tend to be the first loves that we have. There's a wonderful study about that. The conclusion of that researcher is, you know, if you had a high school sweetheart and you're going to your 30th reunion and you're not feeling so good about your marriage, take your spouse or don't go. Because when you go back and you see that high school sweetheart and they see you, first of all, we see each other with the filter of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still 17 and so is he. He might be bald, but I don't see bald. I see, you know, the same hair that was there.
Yeah.
And he sees this, you know, interesting 17-year-old woman when I'm really much older. So, you know, time, our emotional memories do not have a sense of time. So it's not as we get as older we don't fall in love, but if somebody really has sort of a love addiction, you know, they just keep going that, they actually are interfering with their chances to really be with someone because they're just more addicted to that lust and craving for it to be so unique and special. And that's a, you know, that kind of brings up an interesting point. 95% of people want to get married. It doesn't matter what culture they come from, what socioeconomic, what educational level they have. And that was a puzzle for me for a long time. And so why is it that people are driven for that, even when only 50% of the people are getting married and we have a 50% divorce rate? What's driving people? And what I've come to believe is that we all have this yearning to be special to someone.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to be loved by someone who doesn't have to love us. I often tell this story that my son must have been about 7 years old, and I said something. He had done something, and I told him I loved him. And he looked at me, and he said, "But you have to love me." I said, "What do you mean I have to love you? You're my mother. You have to love me." "Oh, really?" You know, I mean, but you know what? But that speaks to, we expect our parents or grandparents or family members who raise us to love us. But as an adult, we really are looking for that validation from someone who doesn't have to love us but does.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that for me, that kind of explains why young people, adults, have this yearning to be with someone who's willing to commit to them for life and say, "You're my one and only, you're my beloved, you're the special one."
And it makes sense that, you know, it's why people keep trying. You know, even in spite of failed relationships, they're right back in the ring and, you know, trying again.
Right. Because we that is part of self-esteem. We want to feel special.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in a good, loving, caring marriage, guess what? You have that feeling. And people who have that do tend to do better in life. You know, we know from the research that people who are married live longer, have more money, have better sex, and generally have a sense of personal satisfaction in their life. We know that if you ask someone who's in an unhappy marriage, are they personally satisfied in their life, the answer is almost always no.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being in a difficult marriage can pull down personal satisfaction. Being in a healthy, loving marriage enhances personal satisfaction because
absolutely.
It helps bring out the best in us.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just talk a little bit about love and sex then, because how does that play out over time? We fall in love in this romantic love, you know, that's the passionate, the romantic love. This is the one and only person for me, this feeling. But love is so much more complex and so much richer than just that early love. And so, you know, I get a little worried when people say, "Well, you have to kind of get over that stage." But the answer is no, you don't want to really get over that, because the seeds of romance and sexual fulfillment and closeness and commitment and caring and friendship are all in there. But they take time to blossom. They take time to grow. You know, they need, like what do they say, you need sunshine and water and all those things. So you take those seeds, and then love begins to grow in many different forms over the course of time. And so by the time people get into the later years, the completion stage, they really feel the impact and the pleasure of having a full-bodied love relationship, not just one that they still have the passion, because you can hear them and they say that, and because all those experiences are really stored in our memory banks. But people really, so love does grow over marriage. It's not that we lose anything. We really are gaining.
And is it a different type of love that we have in the beginning? Can you kind of define that?
I'm trying. I'm trying. You know, this is something that people, you know, scientists and writers and theologians, everybody's been trying to figure out. So I don't want to be too presumptuous to think that I haven't figured out. But I have really been paying attention to what and how people talk about love and what that means to them over time. And so, I think during the cooperation stage is really a good time to build friendship in a couple because they are doing different things. They're building a life together. They're really getting to know each other. One of the mistakes that couples make during the cooperation stage is, you know, he goes and does his thing with his friends and she goes and does her thing with her friends. Well, you've got to have shared activities that you share with each other so that your friendship with each other can grow. And there's so many options that people have. So different stages, I think, are conducive to different kinds of love.
Mm-hmm.
There's some really great studies out right now about compassionate love. And compassionate love is something that often older couples who have, you know, weathered lots of storms with each other and, you know, with family members and other people who really can be very caring and giving people. You know, if you ever go to give blood at the Red Cross, invariably there are some older people there, and they're just to hold your hand.
Mm-hmm.
They get it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They just, oh, you're a little scared. Okay, here's your juice. You know, that's the compassionate, loving kindness that can emerge out of a good, healthy, loving marriage. Because ultimately, who is it usually the hardest for us to give that to? The person we're living with?
Absolutely. Yeah. The one
so
closest to us.
If we can learn to do it at home, it's a lot easier to take out into the world.
Yeah.
Now, the passionate partnership, I think for most people, they say, okay, well, passionate partnership, that means we have a great sex life forever. Is that realistic? Well, I would say it's realistic and practical if you know how to nurture it, and you have to nurture it throughout life. The minute you turn, you know, the minute you ignore it and it goes away and it's been 6 months and we haven't had any kind of physical affection or sexual contact, that's a problem. You know, we know that, you know, some couples have lower desire levels than others, and at certain times in life our desire is up or down. But paying attention, each person has to pay attention to their own sexual energy. That's what makes it exciting, because
mm-hmm.
we do grow. You know, I talk about in workshops all the time, men start at a really high level of desire as a result of the impact of testosterone. Women are at a much lower level of desire because our estrogen levels are much higher. And we, you know, we get a little focused usually in younger years about having children. But over time, you know, the men's testosterone levels start to go down a little bit and the women's available testosterone goes up a little bit. It's proportionate, though. For the men, they feel like they've lost it. And for the women, they're saying, wow, this is great. You know, I've never thought about sex the way I do now.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, over time, if people have nurtured that part and have practiced enough, they're going to stay connected. And in general, and I think there are some of my colleagues who agree with me about this, that couples who are in these loving, caring, committed, cooperative marriages who are continue to be sexual are really the ones that are having great sex.
Yeah. And is it too late to start to create and nurture a passionate partnership?
I don't think
so. Is it ever too late?
I don't think so. I have a couple right now. It's been 10 years since they've been sexual, but they really love each other. They've been through a lot. Part of the reason they haven't been sexual is there have been some pretty serious physical and emotional things that have gone on, but they want to get it back. So the question mm-hmm. is, how will they get it back? And, you know, they're very open to that possibility. And, you know, when I said it is possible, they were like, really? You think so? Well, I can't guarantee it, but, you know, there are some things you can do and see what comes of it. You know, we know so much more about sexuality today than ever before.
Well, do we want to talk about how we do that, how we create and nurture a passionate partnership? I think that's a perfect segue into that discussion.
Well, the nurturing really is about dating your partner. You know, you gotta date. You gotta go out. Just like when we first met, and now a lot of people don't date anymore, but everybody knows what a date is. A date mm-hmm. is we're gonna do something just the two of us. And then some people say, well, what if we go out with our friends? Does that count? It does, but it's not as significant as making time to be with each other. So then people will say, well, how many dates do we have to have? And I usually say, well, how many would you like to have? Because some couples want more and some couples want less. Some couples, you know, going to a movie and talking about the movie afterwards, to them that's a hot date. Not my idea of a hot date, because first of all, we haven't talked for all that time, and usually then you get something and you go home and go to bed, and you know, I'm a therapist. I don't get to talk enough. So for me, I really want time when we can talk and I can talk. And so for me, going for a walk is a great date compared to going to a movie. So people are different. But I do think some regular pattern, you know, I like to encourage people to at least once a month get out on a date. But again, everybody has to learn their own rhythm. They have to understand whatever's going on in their life and what the possibilities are.
Mm-hmm. But the key is that they need to make time for the dating.
Yes. You cannot, you know, nurturing of human relationships takes time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way around it. You know, you need a certain quantity of time for it to be quality time. No way around it. So if we're nurturing our marriages, we got to spend time together.
Mm-hmm.
And we
mm-hmm.
call that dating.
Yeah.
So dating is very important. And so that's the first step. And then I think the other part is paying attention to your own individual sexuality, you know, because sometimes we can get caught up, women in particular, in just pleasing the man or doing things because we feel like we're obligated, not necessarily paying attention to our own desire, our own fantasies. I saw Dr. Ruth on a TV show recently, and she's still as giggly as ever, and she's saying, no, fantasizing is good, and she's absolutely right. And it's usually an individual activity. So that's the other part often for people. We might have the dating going, but we really need to pay attention to our own sexual energy, our own sexual desire. And I think women need to appreciate and men need to appreciate that as men get older, some of them can feel really bad because when they were younger, they didn't really have to do too much for
mm-hmm.
things to happen. They
yeah.
had, you know, testosterone and Mother Nature on their side. Well, as they get older, you know, it takes a little more effort. Some men feel that they're losing their virility, when really it's an exciting time to really get to know each other.
And how does eroticism fit into this? Because sex and eroticism are different things. Eroticism can lead to sex, but
sure.
How important is that for the couple?
Putting it into your life in the ways that are important. You know, some people have talked about how sex in everyday life. Well, you know, being the visual things that you like and the touching and the smells and the environment you're in, what's important to you? How do you surround yourself so that you stimulate your senses in ways that are important? You know, some people like candles and music and some people don't. They would
mm-hmm.
much prefer, you know, being outdoors. So paying attention to your own sensuality, what your turn-ons are, where, you know, and giving yourself permission to explore your eroticism. And, you know, for some of us, we've only been kind of given narrow permission about that. It can only be about this person in this way, when really there's our partner, there's ourself, there's nature, there's environment, you know, like creating an environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these days, all these good sheets, you know, they have at the hotel.
Oh,
you can go
yeah.
to the hotel. You don't have
the candles, everything.
Oh, yeah. Have them at home, too. You know,
yeah.
if you go to one of these places and say, wow, this is the best bed I ever slept in, find out where they got the sheets and order mm-hmm. some. You want to have that in your life if that's important to you.
So it's kind of like just broadening your horizons around the things that give you pleasure.
Yes. And that's what sex is about, pleasure
yeah.
and fulfillment. And, you know, taking more time or not taking time, realizing that, you know, it's an exploration. And our bodies change. It's not
mm-hmm.
like our bodies are the same every day. We have variations on a daily basis, and we have variations that have to do with aging. So it's always an adventure. It's always an interesting experience. It's not like, you know, I think it's a compliment when my husband says now that I'm not the girl he married. I was pretty naive and immature and self-centered. I'm much better now, you know, and I can appreciate myself and him much more than I did at the time. So, you know, that whole thing about growing and becoming aware and giving permission to the sexual part of myself. I've had people say, well, how old you are when it stops? I'm like, well, last time I checked in all my research, it doesn't for the people who really want to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's an important message for people to have.
Big message. Very, very important.
I also say, this, what's that show, Dancing with the Stars. People come on, you know, you get this person who's an expert and this other novice. Well, they don't dance together pretty well in the beginning, but some of them make it to the finals. And what's the difference between the ones who make it to the finals and the ones who, they practice. They're determined. They want to get it. So I usually tell people, great sex takes a lot of practice. If you want to have great sex with your partner, you need the practice. It's not just going to happen hit or miss once in a while without communication. So I have an attitude that it's the kind of thing that if we use it, it'll develop and grow.
Yeah.
But if we ignore it, it is going to wither.
Rita, that little gem about practice was worth the price of admission.
Oh, good.
I think it was so important that you've highlighted that. Thank you.
And also, but, you know, you have to remember, I don't know, some people have practiced learning, you know, a new skill, piano, skiing, golf, whatever. You know, when you're just learning something and you're just working at it and you're practicing, you don't always get it right. We're so hard on ourselves when it just doesn't work right. That's just the nature of life. You know, taking those things in stride, what can we learn from it? You know, we might say, okay, we're going to have this romantic evening. Well, we have the romantic evening, but we get in a big argument. Now what do we do? How about a do-over? Okay, let's do that over. Life got in the way. Let's try again.
Yeah.
So I think practice, but not. It doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, we're so hard on ourselves about that.
Good
Women
point.
In particular, yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about nurturing a passionate partnership. We talked about dating. We talked about sexuality, eroticism. What else do we have?
A lot of territory. Well, the other thing I have that I like to talk about is how love and sex work together, the interplay of them.
Okay.
Because from my point of view, you know, we think, okay, love is really what it's about. Sex is sort of filler. But in these days and times, you know, sexuality is really a comfort for couples. And it's actually, I kind of think of it as a container and a way to hold the relationship and to keep all the good things that go on in the relationship, hold it all together. Because what else do we have that protects one couple's relationship from another? And when couples let their sexuality go by the wayside, often those relationships get in trouble because in this world today, there are lots of people out there. And most of us are pretty busy and active in our life, and it's unrealistic to think that we're not going to bump into somebody. So here if I'm deprived and feeling kind of lonely and I meet somebody who starts giving me attention, you know, it's just going to happen that I'm going to have some interest. So having a good, loving, fulfilling sexual relationship, I think it's like the old-fashioned white picket fence. You know, you put your picket fence around your house, and that was a sign to the neighbors that you don't come in here unless you're invited.
Mm-hmm. So, great image.
You know, so with our sexual relationship, if that's there, it forms that boundary between us and the rest of the world. And I think people need to really appreciate how important that is. I think it was one of your other speakers who said that when we take our vows, we don't promise to be faithful even when we are not keeping to the vow of loving each other and being sexual with each other.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I'm going to be monogamous no matter what, even if you stop being sexual or you don't love me very often. So that's not a good thing. That's
no.
not the agreement that we're making. We have more options.
Yeah. And I like your visual of this boundary, this picket fence, because it is so true. That's what makes the relationship that a couple has so special, so different, is the sexual component.
Right.
You know, above all other relationships.
Exactly. And that yeah. because that is how we interpret being special. You're my
mm-hmm.
beloved.
Yeah.
You know, it's erotic love. What is that? Well, Eros, I always heard that was Cupid, you know, and Cupid's arrow hits. Well, you know, some of those couples who fell in love, they don't necessarily automatically become sexual. They have different things that happen in their lives or their circumstance, but they always have that feeling. And so the Eros is really about having someone be special to you. And, you know, some of us have trouble with that because, you know, that's a scary feeling. You can let somebody depend on you and you're going to depend on them, and that gets us into all kinds of issues. It usually
mm-hmm.
stirs up our childhood issues for most of us. But, you know, when we fall in love, it is really about the special person. So where do we have that boundary? I think it is in our sexual relationship. If we look at what happens to couples when that vow or commitment to fidelity is broken, I mean, it really, you know, creates havoc.
Yeah, it's a significant challenge to the relationship for sure.
Yep. I mean, look at how many programs and talks there are about, you know, recovering from infidelity, forgiving,
mm-hmm.
having to work through all that. And it's very unusual, although it certainly does happen. It can happen in couples who have a really close relationship, but generally it's much more protective than people think. And so I think people need to realize that if you really want to have that sort of that veil, that shield from the outside world, you have to create that in your relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sex is the best way that I think we have to do that.
That's great advice. It really is. You've delivered quite a few gems, really some big golden nuggets, actually, you know, in this program, and I really appreciate that.
Good.
We have just a little over 10 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we cover, you know, the few other things that you want to discuss. And I'd still like to, if we have time, is go back and just talk briefly about the challenges of some of these stages, if not all of them, and how we can overcome them. And actually, we do have a question that's kind of a segue into that, and it's how can a couple overcome the challenges of the passion stage?
The challenges of the passion
stage. Yeah.
Well, the challenge in the passion stage is to work at and maintain those early experience and preserve those passionate times. You know, sometimes when people, they're in love and they want to get committed, they want to get married, and they want to get going, often I'll say to them, why not just slow down and enjoy this time? Because you are creating memories and experiences that are going to help you when times get rough. So the challenge of the passion stage is, you know, you're the one for me. Okay, let's settle down and make a home. Rather than just enjoying, you know, the fun and the excitement of all that chemistry and all the stuff that's happening. So I think it's really important for people to take advantage of that time
mm-hmm.
and enjoy it and savor it for what it is before going on to the challenges of life, which, you know, they're always there anyway.
Yeah, and I think if people understood that this was the first stage, they mm-hmm. would probably be more comfortable just experiencing and just being in that stage rather
right.
than kind of trying to shift it into something else.
Right. Although when people are in love, it's, you know, they look at you like, you don't understand.
Yes, well, we've all been there.
Yeah, you can't possibly know. I just have to be there every day. Well, yes, I do. But you know what? Enjoy it. Don't rush it. Take your time. This, you know, it is the time for creating a sense of we. You know, we as a couple. we're going to create those special memories. So that's a really important part of the passion stage that I think people forget. You know, so especially goal-oriented, driven people, you know, we've got to have a family settled down, get a house, blah, blah, blah. You know, these are such special times, and it's such a wonderful gift that we have as human beings. Why not enjoy it?
So that's
the passion stage. The realization stage, that I think the key challenge there is to learn how to be empathetic, because it is heartbreaking when you move from the passion stage where you feel completely understood to the realization stage where you think the person doesn't even know what language you're speaking. So in the realization stage, really starting to learn how to empathize and have empathy for your partner is very significant. It's, you know, we all know in communication we need to listen, but it's not just listening. It's starting to really get to know the other person and understand them at a deeper and deeper level. That's how people become soulmates, having more compassion for the experiences. Sometimes we'll talk about, you know, when couples are in the realization stage that they find out things about the other person that they never, well, you never told me that. Well, first of all, we haven't had a life together, but now that you've heard that, maybe, you know, it's about something painful that happened in my life that I just hadn't talked about. You know, I was too distracted by all the other stuff going on between us. So really beginning to cultivate the roots and seeds of deep compassion for our partner is very important in the realization stage.
And I'm also hearing that communicating and maybe learning a communication protocol so that it's not about the emotion. It's about a process that lets you be the listener and the speaker so that you have clearly defined roles and you can discuss really anything. And that can open the door to compassion.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and that it's so important. And it is, it's such a key skill. You know, there are many of us who think, you know, everybody has to do this, you know, because it's really, it's like taking vitamins and taking care of your health and exercise. Yes, we have to take turns. We're going to get stuck. We need to learn how that process works. And we need to know how to work it. Because in the rebellion stage, what you really have to start to learn to deal with is the differences that you have with each other. And the differences are often much more dramatic than people think. The way we handle money, the way we like to handle traditions, you know, events in our life, the way we manage time. I didn't know you were a morning person. I didn't know you were a night person. I remember my husband said, you know, you're awfully grumpy in the morning. Well, I'm a night person. He said, well, I'm not. Now what do we do? I had to learn how to be more cheerful in the morning. And guess what? I'm a pretty decent morning person now, but it took 25 years of working at it. But it's like a key difference that we just had between us. So I could have said, well, I'm just a night person, and that's just the way it is, and I'll be grumpy in the morning, and you'll have to learn not to speak to me. Well, my husband is a talker, and my not speaking to him doesn't work for him. So that, you know, we had to negotiate that. So the seeds of conflict resolution come from really understanding and having compassion for the other person, and that we can grow in the relationship. I mean, that's the good news. That when I'm willing to confront my challenges and my weaknesses, I'm going to be a more caring, compassionate, loving, supportive person in general. If you're doing it at home, you're certainly going to be doing it out in the world. You can be doing it out of the world, but if you're not doing it at home, it's fragile. It's hard to hold on to.
That sounds, too, like it's about taking accountability in this stage, you know, for your responses, for your choices, for your, you know, the changes in behavior and the actions that you want to take, you know, to accept the differences and, as you said, negotiate that. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and that's why if people are a little older when they make the commitment and get married, these things can be a little easier than when you're younger, because when you're younger, you just don't know as much. But the challenges are the same, and so for younger people, having supportive mentoring people around them can be really important and helpful. Because if you can get through those stages, the passion, realization, rebellion, and really have the seeds for a cooperative, working, loving relationship, all you're going to be doing during the cooperation stage is refining that.
Mm.
That by the time you come to the end of the cooperation stage, you go into the reunion stage, you might not have to be worrying about who's paying the bills and are things being taken care of and, you know, is money in the bank where it ought to be, and, you know, we're not necessarily arguing about what kind of car we're going to have or not have, or, you know, how many vacations. It makes life a lot more comfortable.
Because you're on the same page. You know, I hope you should be at that point on the same page. And you know, your point earlier about people either go deeper into the relationship or call it quits after, you know, the 25, 30 years together when it's an empty nest, is because they're not on the same page and they can't get on the same page. But if you've done that work.
Right, and they usually know that they have been developing their own individual lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually... It can be if there's an affair, but if two people really haven't been working it and one decides to leave, it's usually not as bad as it is earlier on when people are traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people have been. He has his life, she has her life. He has his friends, she has her friends. But, you know, some of those couples decide to stay together out of convenience as well. So, you know, it just really depends. As I said, I hope in this, there are many different ways to make this work. And each couple has an opportunity to figure it out, that what works for them based on who they are, the challenges they bring, the experiences they've had together. And for some couples, they really want to have it all. And for other couples, you know, an easygoing route through life is okay with them. We all get to choose. But at least from my point of view, I think couples need to know what the possibilities are.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And once you know what the possibilities are, okay, then I can make some choices about what I think will work for me.
Yeah, that whole awareness piece is huge, because until you're aware, you can't see the choices that are presented.
Yeah, knowledge is power. I don't remember where I heard that, but, you know, it's so true. And knowledge can bring us freedom and give us more choice. So I like to think about the seven stages, and the work that I've been doing is about giving people knowledge and also giving them skills. And with the skills, they can develop habits and relationships that they really want to have to the extent that that's important to them. It's not that it has to be this particular model. You know, there are some couples who love to do everything together, and some they just, you know, they have a certain amount of time together, and they're both happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are couples who have long-distance relationships, and it works for them. But it usually means that they're working at it in some kind of way, and they know themselves, and they know what they want, and they've got all the ingredients, because it just doesn't last otherwise.
No. And what I really love about the seven stages, the way it's laid out, I mean, it does provide a framework for people to understand what they can expect. That when things are going wrong, you know, it may just be an aspect of the stage that they're in, and not to panic, you know, that there's hope.
Right.
You know, to move through that relationship and have the type of relationship that you really want.
And also that change is inevitable. And this is a journey, and it may be, I remember when my kids were, you know, younger, and we went to the sports events, and we spent that time, and we had fun, and and that was a wonderful time, but guess what? That's not how life goes. You're not just going to have that. There is going to be change.
Yeah.
It is a journey, and, you know, some journeys have more rapids than others, but it is a journey, and I think that, and change is inevitable. And the hope that we don't have to give up, though, is the hope of having an ongoing loving relationship. It's not that, you know, we fall in love and then we just have to build this practical partnership. I just, you know, the model that my mother gave me just didn't prove that out. And the more I've been in the field and people I've met, it's not true. It's just for some people, they haven't nurtured it. And it's not a failing. It's just they don't know how.
Yeah. And I think that's a perfect ending for an amazing session. Rita, I really appreciate the time that you spent, the information that you've given us. It's been so deep, so simple. I mean, that's what I love about it. It's simple, but it's deep at the same time. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay. And you've been listening to Creating a Passionate Partnership with Rita DeMaria. And I just want to ask you to please click on the feedback link on your program page and let us know what you thought of this program, and we'll share your feedback and comments with Rita. And we hope you join us in 15 minutes at 11:30 a.m. Pacific, 2:30 p.m. Eastern for Conscious Dating with David Steele. So thank you so much for your participation in our Conscious Relationship Summit.